MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, British Prime Minister Tony Blair testifies that if accusations that he hyped intelligence were true, he would have resigned by now.
And British TV copes with no cameras in the inquiry with reenactments of Tony Blair.
This was an absolutely fundamental charge. This was an allegation where, if true, that would have merited my resignation.
Also, why is it that black women die from heart attacks more frequently than white?
My best guess is that there is an underestimation of the risk that black women face from heart disease. I don't think there's any reason to believe that there's any conscious effort to treat black women any worse than white women.
These stories and the man some say invented reggae coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The Bush administration appears to be open to the possibility of establishing a UN-backed multinational force in Iraq. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage says the idea is one of several being looked at by the administration as it struggles with continuing violence and sabotage in Iraq, but he said any such force would have to be headed by an American commander. British Prime Minister Tony Blair told a hearing at the Royal Court of Justice today that a BBC report implicating his government in a conspiracy to exaggerate intelligence on Iraqi weapons was false. NPR's Guy Raz is in London. He tells us Blair denied that his government hyped the information about Iraq's weapons program.
Prime Minister Tony Blair told the inquiry today that he would have quit if the charges that were leveled against him by the BBC, that is, that his government exaggerated weapons claims about Iraq, if those claims were true, the prime minister would have resigned. He appeared very confident and self-assured today in front of the Hutton inquiry, the inquiry looking into how and why a government weapons expert committed suicide. Tony Blair's government has been under intense pressure to come clean about its role in exposing the government weapons expert who did give that information to the BBC for that broadcast.
NPR's Guy Raz in London. There's been no official announcement yet, but South Korean and Russian officials say the Six Nations meeting in Beijing and North Korea's nuclear program have reached consensus on holding a second round of talks. Russia, China, Japan, the United States, and the two Koreas are in the midst of a three-day meeting, which has been seen as the first in a series of tough rounds of negotiations. Officials with several Islamic charities in the Gaza Strip say the Palestinian Authority has frozen dozens of their bank accounts. Israeli officials welcomed the move. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Officials from the Islamic charity said hundreds of Palestinians who rely on welfare payments from charities tried to pick up their monthly support checks at banks in Gaza City today. They were told by the banks that they could not receive their money because the accounts had been frozen. Officials in the Palestinian Monetary Authority declined comment, but the Bush administration has been pressuring the Palestinian Authority to take this move. The Associated Press reported at least 36 accounts belonging to nine charities were frozen, including the Jemaah Islamiyah and the Islamic Young Women's Association. Palestinian analysts said these organizations are tied to Hamas, which runs a widespread network of charity programs in the West Bank and Gaza. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 14 points to 93.19 in light trade. The Nasdaq is up 6 points to 1788, and the S&P is down a fraction. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, an organization of online music broadcasters has filed suit against the Recording Industry Association of America. It claims the association is trying to put small webcasters out of business. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
The Webcaster Alliance accuses the RIAA of colluding with such large companies as AOL to give them an unfair advantage in streaming music over the Internet. According to Alliance President Anne Gabriel, the RIAA has favored large webcasters by keeping royalty rates artificially high, so only the large companies can afford to broadcast music. The Webcaster Alliance is pressing for the elimination of royalties. Instead, the Alliance prefers paying a flat percentage of revenues towards royalties. That's closer to how it works in radio. The RIAA is calling the suit a publicity stunt, but Gabriel says the suit was filed with every intention of winning. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
The Commerce Department has revised its report on second quarter economic growth, saying the economy grew at an annual rate of 3.1%, not the 2.4% originally reported. But markets haven't rebounded on the news. Economist Hugh Johnson says traders are focused on rising interest rates.
Wall Street is a little bit hesitant, largely because we've seen a very sharp rise or increase in interest rates. And quite frankly, that there's a worry that the rise in interest rates is going to start to take a bite out of growth in the third and the fourth quarter. That's one of the negatives as we look at the third and fourth quarter. But I don't think the rise in interest rate is going to take much out of economic growth in the third and fourth quarter. Some, but not a lot.
Johnson is with First Albany Corporation. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Everybody's coming now! Tony, Tony, Tony! Tony, Tony, Tony!
British Prime Minister Tony Blair ran a gauntlet of protesters in London this morning, entering the Royal Courts of Justice to answer questions about the presumed suicide of government scientist David Kelly. Kelly has been identified as the source of a BBC report that said Blair's government had sexed up evidence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Blair is only the second British prime minister to face a judicial inquiry. John Major's the first in 1994, and ironically, that hearing involved the export of defense equipment to Iraq. Well, today, Blair's reputation, along with that of the venerable BBC, is on the line. Joining us from London is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Robin.
What's the headline from today's hearings?
Well, the headline from today's hearing really is that people have wondered, why did Tony Blair get involved in this row with the BBC in the first place? And he made it very clear early on in his testimony this morning that the charge that Downing Street, meaning his office, had inserted a claim that Saddam Hussein could launch weapons of mass destruction via rockets in 45 minutes had been inserted against the wishes of the intelligence community.
That's the charge.
That is the charge. And what Blair said today is that is an absolutely fundamental charge, and it would have merited my resignation if it had been true. And he over and over returned to this point, and at one point said, I don't want you to think I'm overly sensitive about this, but the BBC, even simply correcting slightly, which the BBC had done, wasn't sufficient. That the BBC had to retract the story and say it simply was not true. And, of course, the BBC still hasn't done that, and the public debate has moved on from, was the government wrong to take us into war with Iraq, to, has the government duped us? And I think if you look at the public opinion polls, the majority of the country thinks the government did dupe the British public into its reasons for war.
But tell us, Michael, what really is the purpose of the inquiry? And I mean, on a very basic level, isn't this inquiry about whether or not David Kelly, a government scientist, whether or not his name was leaked by the government as the source of that information to the BBC?
Yes. And in fact, Blair dealt with that today. Throughout these proceedings, all of his government members have kind of ducked and dived on how the name David Kelly came out. But today, on three separate occasions, Tony Blair said, look, I take responsibility for that. We knew that the name was likely to come out, and so we had to control how it came out.
Well, Michael, it seems as if there are two issues here. How did David Kelly's name come out? And you just discussed that. But then the second one is, who's telling the truth about the information? And how did Blair come off in his presentation?
As he always does, Robin, every time he is called into a public forum and people are saying, oh, there's no way he can explain this or he can explain that, he stands up and acts like the high-flying lawyer he was before he entered politics full-time.
Well, while Prime Minister Blair and the BBC battle over their reputations, there was a lot going on at the courthouse. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, there were about 50 people, mostly young, who had, you know, brought their sleeping bags and slept out overnight. It's kind of like, you know, kids who are waiting to buy tickets for the Stones or something. Or, and I asked two middle-aged women in the queue who had slept out overnight why they were there. And among the words they said that I can actually use on radio is they found Blair to be sycophantic and arrogant, and they were there to see him
squirm,
in a sense, called to account.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you very much.
Robin, thank you.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb, he spoke to us from London.
Well, as Michael Goldfarb just said, Tony Blair was masterful in court today, but no one could see him on television because cameras aren't permitted in the courtroom. So each night for the past 11 days of the inquiry, British television has been recreating key parts of the testimony using actors. On the line now from London is Tony Keach, who's playing the Prime Minister in the recreation that airs tonight. And welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
And also Tim Marshall. He's the presenter of the program on Sky News and foreign affairs editor there. And hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, Tony, you've played Tony Blair before, I understand. Anything particularly challenging about portraying him?
Well, you obviously have more responsibility because you're playing a real person. You can't caricature them, especially something like this. It's not as though I'm doing a comedy show. It's a piece of journalism.
I imagine it could get kind of challenging because you could be criticized for portraying him as either too sympathetically, as very much in command, or the opposite. That must be kind of tricky.
It is, because I could be interpreting one of his, something he says in the inquiry in
right.
one way, whereas in fact he actually said it in a completely different way.
You'll be reading off a teleprompter too, right?
That's right, yes.
So how much of a challenge is that for an actor?
It's a bit scary. Obviously, it would be impossible to learn that amount of stuff. It's reading out loud, basically, and acting at the same time.
Of course, what's interesting is you do have a bit of Tony Blair sound in your voice. You kind of sound like him.
So I've been told, yes.
Tim Marshall, what are the mechanics of this? How do you turn this all around?
It's pretty fast-paced, Bill. We have to wait until the transcripts of the entire day's evidence are emailed to us by the inquiry. Huh. And that then gives us about 4 hours to get through about 180 pages of evidence. And we've got to go through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure we don't miss something that other people have missed. We then have to get chunks of it which are intelligible. Because remember, we're dealing with civil servants and politicians
yeah.
who have a way of speaking for 40 seconds without actually saying anything. So, you know, we've got to pick out these meaningful, pertinent points. If they don't make much sense, and it's clear the politician is trying to evade the question, we set it up with an introduction by myself to say, okay, in this next bit, we see how politician X attempts to say why he wasn't at meeting Y. But it's pretty fast-paced stuff, and I've never done anything like this before. The reason we're doing it is because some of our establishment still live in the 1960s and felt this could not be televised, whereas I was reminded that your Watergate hearings were televised way back in the 70s.
It must be very tricky pulling out the important bits, and it's also a thicket of complications, all this business of WMD and the Blair administration.
Yeah. It is so difficult, I think, for the general public to follow the twists and turns that you have to give them the broad brush. And even a 30-minute program is broad brush, given that you're dealing with 5 hours of evidence. But I would say, and I'm trying not to boast too much, but nowhere else in the broadcasting world in this country do you get that amount of time devoted to actual slabs of evidence read out as it was said in court so that people can make their own minds up about every single word that was said. Although I do take on board your question to Tony about nuances of language and speech. You know, we have to keep an eye on the actors, who of course are professionals, but to make sure that they don't perhaps go overboard.
Well, Tony, let's get a sense of what you may be presenting to the British public tonight. Can you read us a bit of a transcript that may be on the air tonight?
All right, then. Here we go. This was an absolutely fundamental charge. This was an allegation where, if true, that would have merited my resignation. This was an attack that went not just to the heart of the office of the Prime Minister, but also the way your intelligence services operated. It went, in a sense, to the credibility I felt of the country.
Wow, Tony, you've
You got that kind of high-pitched voice, that clipped delivery?
Yeah.
Well, Tony Keach and Tim Marshall, thank you both for joining us on this. I wish we could see it on our television screens here in the U.S. Tony Keach, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Tim Marshall, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tony Keach is playing Prime Minister Tony Blair on Sky News. Tim Marshall is the presenter for the program and also foreign affairs editor at Sky.
U.S. and allied intelligence agencies are looking into the possibility that they were fed false information about Iraq's weapons capabilities by phony Iraqi defectors acting as double agents, and that fabricated intelligence became partly the basis for war. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is L.A. Times reporter Bob Drogan. And Bob, you write today that Saddam Hussein might have sent these double agent defectors. Why would he do that?
The speculation at this point is several things, that he was, one, trying to bluff the West and to bluff his enemies in Tehran into thinking he had something to deter an attack by putting out false information about what his material was. Then UN weapons inspectors would come in and they wouldn't find the things that he said or that he might be alleging were there, and that would, so the theory goes, would embarrass the Security Council and they would lift sanctions. So there are a variety of motives that are being ascribed to this.
Right. And, of course, if the Security Council lifted the sanctions, he could then, again, according to the theory, create the program that didn't exist.
Absolutely.
And according to your writing, he didn't just send the double agents, but he also sent legitimate defectors that he tricked.
That's right, that he put information out there, that people deliberately fed information to legitimate defectors, and because they believed it and they would go to the West and pass polygraph tests, then it would get into the system and there would be tricks to this.
Right. Now, is there any thought that with the U.S. So attacked right now about the sources of intelligence that led up to the war, that perhaps someone in the United States intelligence is floating this whole double agent theory to cover the U.S.'s tracks?
I suppose that's possible. I think it's they're actually rather embarrassed about it because it suggests that something happened and they failed to detect phony information coming into the system. I think the broader question here is that the debate up until now has been whether intelligence was exaggerated or manipulated to bolster support for the war. And this issue is more fundamental. It's whether the actual intelligence itself was correct or was based on incorrect information.
Well, you mentioned the embarrassment. Could that be especially because the CIA and the State Department had long been skeptical of defector informants provided by Ahmad Shalabi, who's the Pentagon-backed exile who now sits on the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council in Baghdad. So it would follow, why didn't they question these other defectors more closely?
The point here is partly that the defectors themselves were not the only source of information on Iraq. Obviously, when Secretary Powell went to the United Nations in February, he cited defector accounts, but he also showed satellite pictures and quoted from transcripts of electronic interception of communications. So there was a variety of sources and means that the intelligence community used.
Is there a suspicion that there was a whole campaign of false information that might have involved satellites or...
No, I don't believe so. On Saddam's side, on Saddam Hussein's side, that there was clearly an effort to deceive the West about what he was doing. There's never been a secret about that. But on the U.S. side, I think what people are now saying is they're complaining about what they say was sort of a subtle atmosphere in which you were expected to get the goods on this guy. And it wasn't that you were pressured to do so, but that once politicians had announced something, that people went out to get what they could to prove the case.
Hmm. Despite what you and others are reporting about the possible double agents, what is the administration saying about the possibility of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
They remain confident that they will find weapons or weapons programs. The Iraq Survey Group, which is the 1,400 people who are over there trying to find these weapons, are supposed to deliver a report next month, and we'll see what progress they've made. What I'm told is they're getting into the kinds of programs that Saddam had, but that they haven't found any weapons at all.
Right. Bob, thank you.
My pleasure.
Los Angeles Times reporter Bob Drogan speaking to us from Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, a new study on why black women die more often than white women from heart attacks.
And later in the program, the Pentagon rethinks the use of cluster bombs, long a problem for civilians, but now also a danger to occupying forces.
More coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Black women are much more likely than white women to die of heart attacks. That's been known for a long time, although the reason has been something of a mystery. Now, from a new study, some insight. Black women, it seems, simply, if sadly enough, get inadequate medical care, even when they have health insurance and access to a doctor. That's the conclusion of a study published in the journal Circulation this week by Dr. Ashish Jha. He joins us now from his office at the Harvard School of Public Health. And welcome, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Doctor, quantify this for us. What's the extra cardiac health risk for a black woman compared with a white woman?
Well, in the study that we looked at, black women had about twice the risk of either having a heart attack or dying from heart disease compared to white women. Nationally, we know that black women have about a 30 to 40% higher risk of dying from heart disease compared to white women.
And this is even taking into account factors like weight, socioeconomic status, so on?
Yeah, if you take all those factors into account, the difference between black and white women narrows somewhat. But even despite all of those factors, black women still have a substantially higher risk of either having a heart attack or dying from heart disease.
So how do you explain it?
Well, part of the explanation has to be treatment. From our study, we found that black women had lower rates of appropriate medication use, lower rates of risk factor control, such as high blood pressure and cholesterol. That contributes to worse outcomes for black women.
So it's about treatment. They're not getting good treatment.
Well, it is partly about treatment. It's obviously partly about those other factors you mentioned, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, and cholesterol. But it's also about treatment.
Now, doctors are not consciously treating black women less aggressively, I hope.
No, I don't think there's any reason to believe that there's any conscious effort to treat black women any worse than white women. My best guess is that there is, either on the part of patients or on the part of doctors, or maybe both, an underestimation of the risk that black women face from heart disease, and that is probably contributing to worse treatment.
We're also talking about women who had health insurance, right?
All these women in our study had health insurance. They had either a primary care physician or a cardiologist, so they were all getting care.
Well, then it sounds like the doctors are not giving them the same attention, information that white women are getting.
It's hard to know what is actually happening in the clinical exam room, and I'm not trying to evade your question, but I think that it's hard to speculate too much. What we do know is at the end of the day, they're not getting the same level of treatment as white women. And more importantly, they're clearly not getting the appropriate level of treatment that they need.
What can be done about it?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, in our study, we found that all women, not just black women, but really all women, were not being treated as aggressively as they ought to be. I think too many people still think of heart disease as a disease that predominantly affects men. Whereas we know that heart disease is the number one killer of American women, and all American women, white women as well as African-American women. So I think an educational campaign that targets doctors to take care of heart disease in a more aggressive way, as well as targets patients, makes them more aware of their risk factors and really asks them to be more proactive in their care, both I think will be very helpful.
Your study was in women because that's part of a much larger ongoing study. Is it reasonable to assume, do you think, that a similar situation exists comparing black and white men?
There's actually better data in men. I think part of the reason we studied women was because women as a group have not received as much attention as men have, especially when it comes to heart disease. But we do know from other studies that have looked at men that black patients often get worse care than white patients.
Dr. Ashish Jha, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ashish Jha is a general medicine fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. Forty years ago today, Martin Luther King Jr. addressed a quarter of a million people from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. He gave a speech that still resounds in the minds of Americans and people all over the world.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
No matter how many times you hear those words, the power in them, really a kind of magic, never seems to diminish. Richard Green is the author of Words That Shook the World, 100 Years of Unforgettable Speeches and Events. He believes that the I Have a Dream speech is the greatest speech of the 20th century and possibly the greatest speech in all of American history.
I really believe that it is, because when you give a speech, it is not the words that create the effect. It is a combination of the words, the tone of voice, and the body language. And unlike the thousands of speeches that I researched over the last 100 years, this speech worked on every possible level. It creates that effect, that emotional effect, just by reading it and by listening to it. And that doesn't often happen. And what most people don't understand is he ad-libbed the last 10 minutes of this speech. And he says in his autobiography that he just had this sense that he wanted to go in a different direction, and off the top of his head, he goes into the I Have a Dream piece and builds and builds and builds. So the speech does start slowly, it's a little more intellectual, and then it becomes passionate, and the connection that he makes is almost a spiritual connection with the 250,000 people and the rest of the world.
Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, cluster bombs fell on Iraq during the war. Now the ones that didn't explode are hurting the shaky peace.
They found them inside buildings. They found them inside the closets, inside homes. What often happens is the first bomblet hits, it blows a hole, and then other bomblets follow it in. They were everywhere.
And he's in his 70s and still touring the world and making music. We'll meet Lloyd Brevett, lilting bassist of the Scatolites.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Transcripts of emergency telephone calls made on September 11th from inside the World Trade Center are being made public today. The records of the calls to Port Authority police are expected to provide new details of what people experienced inside the Twin Towers that day. The Port Authority wanted to renege on an agreement to release the transcripts, which it had promised to the New York Times, arguing it would infringe on the privacy of victims' families. But a judge ruled last week that they must be released by 5 o'clock this afternoon. Today marks the 40th anniversary of a pivotal event in the fight for civil rights. It was on March 28, 1963, that a quarter of a million people marched on Washington and heard Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. NAACP Chairman Julian Bond was there. He says minorities are better off today in many ways, but there are still great disparities in education, income, and life expectancy.
African Americans and racial minorities are better off in many respects in 2003 than was true in 1963. Having said that, remember that for Martin Luther King, this was a dream, and it remains an unrealized dream today.
A march is being held today in Atlanta to commemorate the historic Civil Rights March. Also today, a website is being launched to raise funds for a national memorial for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The site is buildthedream.com. The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq says better intelligence is what's needed there rather than more U.S. troops. General Ricardo Sanchez says the soldiers in Iraq could do a better job if they had improved intelligence. Meanwhile, the Bush administration says it is open to having an un-UN-backed multinational force sent in, but only if it is led by an American. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says he would have had to resign had his office exaggerated the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Blair defended the intelligence he used in justifying the war with Iraq during testimony before an inquiry looking into the apparent suicide of British arms expert David Kelly. The first round of multilateral talks on North Korea's nuclear weapons program ends tomorrow, but there is consensus agreeing that there will be another round of talks. On Wall Street today, the Dow's down 15 points, the NASDAQ is up 6 points, the S&P down a fraction.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Pentagon officials ran tests this week to try to improve the cluster bomb. U.S. forces dropped up to 1.5 million of the bomblets in Iraq, and some estimates say almost half of them are on the ground waiting to explode. A problem for civilians and increasingly for American soldiers. We're joined by two reporters from the Wall Street Journal. Michael Phillips just returned from Iraq. Hello.
Hello.
And Greg Jaffe is a Pentagon reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Let's start with you first. Greg, can you explain how does a cluster bomb work?
Well, it's a big rocket carries up to 900 of these things. The rocket opens up over the battlefield and drops these little bomblets that are about the size of shot glasses. As they spin downward, the little shot glass-sized bomblets arm. And they're supposed to go off when they collide with the ground. But if they hit soft ground or sand, which there's a lot of in Iraq, or trees, then they don't go off, and they sit there in the armed position. And because they're brightly colored, if little children like to play with them, people pick them up, and they explode.
Yeah. And, Michael, from what we understand, they are everywhere, on rooftops and in gardens. What did you see when you were in Iraq?
Well, I was in Karbala, which is one of the scenes of the greatest use of these weapons. And the cluster bomblets were really amazingly everywhere. The munitions team that I was with found them on the roof of a downtown hotel. They found them inside buildings. They found them inside the closets, inside homes. What often happens is the first bomblet hits, it blows a hole through the roof, and then other bomblets fall, you know, follow it in and mm-hmm. land safely where they sit armed and ready to go. Mm-hmm. So they were everywhere in certain parts of the city.
It seems like such a primitive weapon, given the high-tech, precise weaponry we learn about now. Greg, why are they used?
Well, they're important, or the Pentagon believes they're important for attacking mass troops. They're also important for what they call suppression of enemy air defenses. Basically, if you remember, there was an attack with a bunch of Apache helicopters where they flew towards Karbala, and the helicopters got shot up. It was a terrible raid, and most of the helicopters came back unable to fly again and didn't hit their targets. In future raids, what they did is they dropped these cluster bombs. They came down, and they forced all these guys with rocket-propelled grenades and shoulder-fired missiles to take cover, essentially to drop their weapons and take cover. That allowed the Apaches with more precision weapons on them to go in and destroy key targets like tanks and things like that.
Well, let's talk about the so-called dud rate, the number of bomblets that don't go off. The Pentagon says there's between 2% and 6% that don't explode. But GIs told you in the field that as many as 40% are unexploded. In fact, one said to you, I believe, Michael, that there may be 100,000 out there.
Yes, the Marines that I was with in Karbala, you know, spend a lot of time going around looking for these weapons. And some of the guys on the ground thought that the dud rate is about 20 to 40% yeah. in certain areas, soft fields, areas with a lot of date palms, that sort of thing. And keep in mind, while they're called duds, they're not duds in the sense that they won't go off. They just haven't yet gone off.
Well, and Michael, staying with you, it seems as if the troops that you talk to hate these things. Why the use of so many of them, knowing that U.S. forces, I mean, put aside the civilian question for just a moment, but knowing that U.S. forces were going to be marching through them?
There were certainly situations where the danger to U.S. troops was as great as it was to civilians. The Marines at one point attacked the small, regime-friendly town of Salman Pak, south of Baghdad, and I was there for that raid. And we were all sitting around in the middle of the night waiting for the air power that everybody was hoping was going to come and soften up Salman Pak, as they say. And the only thing that was available at the time was a B-52 with cluster munitions. And the Marines, even though they really wanted air support, turned down the offer of the B-52 because they realized a certain number of those cluster bomblets were not going to explode, and then the Marines themselves were going to have to go through that area.
What about the Iraqis' reactions?
Well, I mean, you can imagine. Yeah. I went out with the ordnance disposal teams of the Marines, and some places they'd go and they were incredibly welcome. The people would shove pomegranates and pears in their pockets as they were leaving out of gratitude for them having removed some of these weapons. But then other farmers would berate them. I can't go and work in my field anymore. My children have been wounded. Why doesn't the U.S., which is so powerful, come and remove all of these from my farms?
Well, Greg, as you both write, the military is now rethinking the use of cluster bombs. How so?
Well, I think the military and Secretary Rumsfeld has been pushing the military to think this way, to operate less on sort of brute force and mass and more on sort of speed and surprise. If you have these big cluster munitions, they create no-go areas, you know, areas that you can't drive through because you're worried that you'll lose soldiers. So it limits your ability to kind of maneuver on the battlefield. You pay a price that I don't think they realized as much in the longer term.
Well, some could say, how could they not? I mean, in the first Persian Gulf War, thousands of civilians were killed and injured, according to Human Rights Watch study. And so we knew that that was the after effect. Doesn't this sort of raise the obscene idea that the Pentagon is only concerned about the cluster bombs when they're going to be occupying the country and not when they just kill civilians?
No, I mean, I think that they were concerned with this not just because of the problems with the occupation, but with the actual fighting of the war, too. It did constrain
same point.
Yeah. I mean, look, the humanitarian concerns have been there for a decade, and they feel like the laws of land warfare allow for this kind of fighting. Mm-hmm. And in the past, since the Gulf War, they did put out guidance prior to this war to the commander saying, you know, don't use these in urban areas unless unless you feel like it's absolutely necessary.
Right. Well, one question that we have to address, don't other countries use an auto-destruct mechanism on these cluster bombs so that they don't lie in waiting, they blow up?
Yeah, they use a self-destruct fuse. In fact, the Israelis developed it first. The French and the Germans and the Brits all use some version of these self-destruct fuses, which still leave bomblets on the battlefield. They're not perfect solutions, but they do cut the hazardous dud rate, you know, these armed duds, down from about 6% in some cases to, as you know, less than 1%.
And so why does an American technology have that?
Well, the Army tried a solution, and they spent about $80 million on it, and it didn't work. So the thing failed. They spent 4 or 5 years casting about trying this solution and didn't buy the solution that was already kind of readily available. Mm-hmm. I think part of it, too, was, to be honest, and the Army won't admit this, but that it just wasn't a high priority for them. They had other things that they wanted to spend the money on.
Well, it goes back to that question, and now that, you know, U.S. forces are on the ground with these cluster bombs, it seems like it has become a priority.
I think it's become a little bit more of a priority. Yeah. Even prior to this, I think Secretary Cohen, the Secretary of Defense before Rumsfeld, before he left office, had mandated that by the first quarter of 2005 that all cluster bombs should have a dud rate of less than 1%, and the Army's been working towards that. But mm-hmm. they're still going to have a huge backlog of millions of these bomblets that have a higher dud rate that they will continue to use.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a fascinating and, you know, as you both point out, pretty disturbing topic. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah. Greg Jaffe and Michael Phillips, reporters for The Wall Street Journal.
Well, still to come, ever loved a reggae riff? Well, the Scatolites first found the sound. They backed Bob Marley. They're in their 70s now and still going strong.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Well, our coverage of the controversy over that 2.5-ton Ten Commandments tablet in Alabama drew several responses. The Reverend Stan Duncan of Abingdon, Massachusetts, took issue with a fellow Christian in favor of keeping the commandments in the building. The more he spoke, the more I got the feeling that his real goal was to bring us back to a theocracy run by white Christians and imposed on all who do not agree with us. The kind of world that they espouse would not be one I would feel comfortable living in.
Well, we also received this response from Moacir Sena from Sao Paulo, Brazil. He writes, I see it as another sign of the distancing from American values that made your nation so great. The existence of a wall of separation between church and state is essential for the preservation of rights of all living in the land. But this wall should have some doors and windows, because isolation does not create protection, but rather ignorance.
Our story on the murder of convicted child molester John Gagan drew this response from Stephen Gilmore of Charlotte, North Carolina. While prisoners consider the crime that landed them in prison, be it murder, robbery, arson, rape, etc., to be a rite of passage, there is one crime that is totally unacceptable, the abuse of children. Father Gagan is merely getting his comeuppance for the one crime that is despicable, even to prison inmates.
Our interview with author Michael Parente, who has written a defense of Julius Caesar, drew a lot of responses, most quite positive, though Christian Harder of Randolph, Massachusetts, questioned our math. You're right, Christian, the Roman Republic ended some 2,000 years ago, not 2,300 years ago.
And Michael Clark, a professor of history in Allentown, Pennsylvania, wrote, strange that you should present Michael Parente's views on Julius Caesar as revisionist. His assertion that Roman Republican history has been misinterpreted systematically is mere nonsense. There is precious little in what Parente is saying about the Roman Republic that would strike any practicing ancient historian as controversial.
And finally, Kathy Gunst's recipe for Provençal stuffed tomatoes drew a desperate plea for help from Dorothy DeMarco, attempting to find the ingredients while also delivering the mail in rural New Hampshire. We called Kathy, first of all, to ask how much 6 medium tomatoes should weigh.
6 medium tomatoes should weigh about 4 pounds.
Okay.
You know, it can be a bit more, a bit less. The recipe will work no matter what.
Okay. Well, either way, Dorothy is now lugging around the tomatoes along with the mail. And as she continued on her route, she wanted to stop at the store for the olive puree that you mentioned.
Yes.
She said you called it tapenade. She couldn't find this, so she wanted to make her own tapenade.
It's quite simple, Dorothy, and anyone else who's having trouble finding tapenade. What you do is you want to take a cup of pitted olives, any variety you want. If they're in a very salty brine, you want to rinse them off, and you're going to throw them into a Cuisinart with a clove of garlic and about 1 to 3 tablespoons of olive oil. You don't want to puree it. You just want to pulse it. Use the pulse button on your Cuisinart. Hit it 3 or 4 times until you get a thick, chunky mixture. If you want it to be a true Mediterranean tapenade, you'll also add 2 anchovy fillets. And that's it. It keeps in your refrigerator for several days, and you can use it on the tomato Provençal or toss it with pasta.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Tomato, tomato, let's call the whole thing off.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the wake of Jamaica's independence from Great Britain in 1962, the island nation experienced a vast social and musical revolution, a celebration of positivity, peace, and political power infused the music of many artists and musicians, including three legends named Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Neville Livingston, who made up Bob Marley and the Wailers. They're often considered the fathers of reggae, but they were backed by the music's granddaddies, Jamaica's first and only ska supergroup, the Skatalites. Here they are with Bob Marley and the Wailers, playing the classic Simmer Down. During 1964 and 65, the Skatalites recorded more hits together than any other group in Jamaica's history. And singers from all over the island, Peter Tosh, Toots and the Maytals, Jimmy Cliff, clamored to collaborate with them. The group's style fused boogie-woogie, blues, calypso, and African rhythms, and became a worldwide sensation. The Skatalites were especially popular with the British mod scene in the late 70s and early 80s, and bands like The Specials and Madness co-opted their infectious sound. Today, you can hear the Skatalites' influence in bands like the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. Here's their version of Simmer Down.
Simmer down, my head is too hot, so simmer down, he's gonna get dropped, so simmer down, man, he hears what I say, simmer down, now I've got to simmer down.
By the end of 2003, the Skatalites say they will have played on every continent on the globe. They're in the U.S. now and will head to Japan in September, where they're worshipped. The surviving members of the Skatalites are all in their 70s now. We caught up with one of them when he was in Boston, recording a new CD with Toots of Toots and the Maytals.
Well, I am Lloyd Brevet, member of the Scatterlights.
Lloyd, you're a bass player, and your father was a bass player, right?
Bass player and a bass maker. Yeah.
Lloyd Brevet started playing the bass when he was 15. Today, he's 70-something. He looks years younger than his age, with long dreadlocks, deep eyes, and a wise face. I asked Lloyd how it all began.
Well, it's got come about that we start to make, to turn the music around. First, we play boogie. We call it boogie boogie. The bass line play that, dum dum dum, and the guitar player start to play this, yeah, 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 and the drum change the beat. And at that time, we never think about making reggae, not rock steady as yet. We never thought about that. We just go in with the ska.
Jamaica like in the 60s when ska was really coming to life?
Well, Jamaica, as I tell you, we was playing different music with different band, big band, playing stock arrangement music, American music, and if we get the English music, that very good for dances. Come Jamaica was a bright people. People love dance around, you know? So Jamaica get to love it. So they want to know a musician that really making this music, and we get together and as a band and name it Scatterlight and get on the road.
This is like 40 years ago, and now the music's loved all over the world. How do you feel about having created something that didn't just become incredibly popular in Jamaica, but became incredibly popular all over the world? It changed music. How do you feel about that?
I feel good. Yeah, man. Like, I feel good, and to know that the most of the musicians, especially in the United States, young youths, they come up and they say, Scatterlight, it really... follow. This is the bass line that I really play.
Lloyd, how old were you when you first played that bass line that would later be all over the world in so many other musicians' music?
In my late 30s.
How did it come to you?
Well, the bass that I play, you know, I give my father the almighty jaw, you know, that I just play from him. I play the line to get the people dancing. That's how I play my, really play my bass, you know.
With Lloyd Nibb since you were 15, right?
We played together from 15. When you have places in Jamaica that they, in the nights, they open and call it Coney Island. And musicians play there, all the great musicians go there in their young days. Me, Lloyd Nibb, Ernest Ranglin, and all these great men, Roland Alfonso. When we have nowhere to go, we go to the Coney Island and play.
as I was finishing up my very upbeat conversation with Lloyd Brevet, a bit of a sad note did creep in. The Scatolites do feel they weren't always paid what they deserved for all the great musicians they played with. Though Lloyd Brevet couldn't help but end our time together with words uplifting like his music.
Because we do a lot of albums, all these albums that you hear, with Jimmy Cliff, I myself, with Jimmy Cliff, all these artists in Jamaica. If it wasn't Toots, tell you the truth, which when Toots come up together, when Toots coming in studio, he comes straight to us. The first set of music that Toots put out, Scatolite Planet. First set of music that Bob Marley put out, Scatolite Planet. First album that Jimmy Cliff go out on. And I don't see no justice that none of us get. I feel like resigning and we'll deal with job personal, you know? Yeah, man.
Deal with job personally, huh?
Yeah.
Not too soon, okay, Lloyd? Not too soon. Lloyd Brevet, thanks very much for talking to us.
Yeah, man, you're welcome, man. And I feel good talking to you also.
Lloyd Brevet, bass player for the ska supergroup The Scatolites. Their new CD is called From Paris with Love.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Jordana Gustafson, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Money from Indian gaming interests has become a factor in the California governor's race.
And with Labor Day around the corner, our film panel offers up their favorite movies about work.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.